WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 2nd, 2009. We have a terrific show for you today with one of our most popular guests, Janine Jackson from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, will be joining us live. We'll be talking about the press coverage of all the great issues of the day, plus take a look at the state of the news media themselves going forward. We'll welcome your questions and comments. It should be a wonderful hour. But first, before we go to Janine Jackson, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Google is expanding its book search service to include millions of new titles. People will be browsing, purchasing, and reading digital books in record numbers. And in some ways, having a vast digital library at your fingertips is good news. But some of the details of the new digital book business are troubling to privacy watchdogs. There's a difference between owning a paper book and purchasing that same book in digital form, says Cindy Cohen, legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
These new transactions that we're starting to have are presented as if you're like buying a book, but you're not actually buying a book. You're buying the right to access a book under certain specified terms that are generally significantly less than what you get when you buy a book.
One of those specified terms have to do with consumer privacy, which has Cohen very worried. Google will have access to a vast amount of consumer information. They'll be able to monitor the books you search for, what pages you linger on, and what you buy. EFF is partnering with the ACLU of Northern California and the Samuelson Law, Tech, and Public Policy Clinic at the University of California to press Google to take steps to protect privacy.
We have strong protections for our reading habits when we're in libraries, and bookstores have generally stood up for strong protections for purchasers of books, too. There's some very famous cases about this. And all we're asking Google to do here is to take a very public and enforceable position that they will hold to those. They won't mean that the switch to digital libraries is something we pay for with our privacy.
Library privacy laws were written before there was a digital library, and they're written for public libraries. Cohen says that Google could easily build consumer protections in their policies.
In some ways, it's very little to ask Google to do. I mean, we're not saying that if the courts say Google has to turn it over, we're not telling Google they have to defy a court order. We're just saying that Google has to try to protect people's privacy. And if they fail, then I think taking this case to the Congress and the various legislative bodies becomes a much more powerful case to do.
Cohen hopes Google will step up and institute privacy protections on their own.
We really have traditionally protected reading privacy as one of the really high points of people's privacy protections. And I just think it would be a shame if we let that slip away from us as we move to the digital age.
For more information about Google's book search service and the Electronic Frontier Foundation's efforts to protect consumer privacy, go to EFF.org. And now a commentary by Media Minute's own Candace Clement.
In a passionate speech in Colorado on Tuesday night, former CBS News anchor Dan Rather called on President Obama to form a White House commission on journalism and public media. Citing declining investment in investigative journalism and the loss of news outlets that regularly monitor institutions of power, Rather said that all citizens should be concerned about the crisis in journalism. A democracy and free people cannot thrive without a fiercely independent press, he said. Indeed, this would not be the first commission to take up the issue of public media. In 1967, a Carnegie Foundation-backed commission released a landmark report, Public Television, a Program for Action. The commission recognized that a public television and later public radio system was necessary to provide an instrument for the free communication of ideas in a free society. The commission's report was quickly taken up by President Johnson's administration, and within 9 months, the Public Broadcasting Act, which established the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, was passed into law. A new commission that focuses on the unique demands and opportunities of today's media landscape has the potential to project a broad new vision for public media in the digital age. Public media may provide some of the critical journalism our democracy needs, but it is continuously hamstrung by a vicious cycle of paltry funding. The United States spends just $1.35 per person on public media, compared to more than $80 per person in the UK and $100 per person in Denmark and Finland. And most public media programming does not yet reflect the true diversity of the nation. These important issues around funding and diversity, as well as the governance and expansion of the public media system, require attention from Washington if we are ever to create a public media that meets the needs of the American people.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national, nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Come to you live today in WILL AM 580 this August 2nd, 2009. And we have as our guest one, I think, actually, if I'm not mistaken, the very first guest we had, or the first or second week we did Media Matters, going back 7.5 years. And she's been on many times since then, one of our favorite guests on the show. Our guest today, of course, Janine Jackson, the program director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting based out of New York, a frequent contributor to Fairs Magazine, Extra, and also the co-host and producer of Fairs syndicated radio show Counterspin, which airs right here on WILL AM 580 every Saturday night at 10 p.m. Janine Jackson, welcome to Media Matters.
Always a pleasure, Bob.
Well, you know, I know it's a summer and you've got a family and this is your time off, so we especially appreciate your willingness to take time to be on a live program so callers can participate and ask you questions. And there certainly is a lot to cover. And I think the place to start is with the dominant news story of the last few weeks, well, except for Michael Jackson, of course. But, I mean, getting past that, which is the healthcare debate. And I know that FAIR, looking at the website, has really spent a great deal of time examining the news coverage of the healthcare debate, of the health insurance debate, as the Obama administration now frames it. And what sort of general lessons are there or observations that you would make about the nature of the press coverage of the healthcare debate?
Well, it really is one of the clearest examples to me, Bob, this coverage of the difference between good journalism and corporate journalism. You know, it just seems just larger than life in this case, where you have a situation where, I mean, to make one obvious point that I'm sure won't surprise a lot of people, the fact that a majority of Americans, and at this point even a majority of physicians, say they want to at least explore the idea of publicly funded, a kind of Medicare for all healthcare system. You know, people are genuinely interested in that, despite the absence, and, you know, we're talking really utter absence of that perspective from the news media. And for me, it's a really an example, a clear example of corporate media getting in the way of a public debate, really getting in the way of a democratic conversation about one of the most crucial issues that there ever could be, a genuinely life and death issue. You know, so the absence of this conversation about single payer in the corporate media, where you can't say it's because the public isn't interested, you can't say it's because doctors aren't interested, you can't even say it's because members of Congress aren't interested in this possibility. It is the corporate media themselves that are keeping that conversation completely off the table. And I think that's, you know, you have to start with that as the most striking thing. We're having an editorial conversation about the costs, human and economic costs, of the current system, and yet the most obvious response to precisely those concerns about costs is studiously avoided. It really is to use an overused term, Orwellian, you know, to have this conversation that's kind of missing the biggest issue in the middle of the room. And then the thing is, we know they can talk about it. I remember a piece, a New York Times piece by David Leinhardt about just a year or so ago, in which he said openly, you know, a lot of people are interested in exploring a Canadian style or a Medicare for all kind of health care option in this country. The reason we shouldn't pay much attention is because it's just not possible. And the reason it's not possible is, and he said, the private insurance industry made X billion dollars last year. And an industry that big, you just don't legislate out of business. Well, I thought that was crystalline. I thought that was very clear, and I really welcomed that clarity on the issue. The trouble is we don't hear that all the time. I think if people heard it presented as there's an insurance industry that some people are interested in propping up above all other concerns, then people would have a much clearer idea what side of that debate they're on, you know. But that's not been the journalism that we've been getting, and it just seems to me so clear, the failings of allowing our journalism to be so completely controlled and our public conversation to be so largely dominated and controlled by these corporate outlets.
You know, one of the assumptions in the news coverage of the healthcare debate, as far as I can tell, and I've watched more than my share, read quite a bit, is that this issue falls along left-right lines, not just in Washington, Republicans, Democrats, but out in the country itself among the people, and that therefore Max Baucus and Ben Nelson and conservative Democrats, since they come from what are regarded as more conservative states, are simply accurately reflecting the concerns of their constituents when they are concerned about the Obama health care plan. This is almost taken as an article of truth. Is there evidence for this?
Despite its failure to comport with all the polling data that I'm aware of, you know, and that indicate that, first of all, there's a problem with the polling in that people are not often asked about a single-payer or Medicare-for-all type of option. If you don't ask the question, then people can't answer it. You know, people can't call for something when it's not one of the available choices. But then again, when it is presented to them, you have data that indicate, you know, 59% of the public in some polls, and they're not all leftists, you know. These are not all even Democrats. These are folks who, like most of us, have direct experience of the system that we have here and think that there has to be something better and are open to at least a conversation about a better way to do it and would like to be permitted to have that conversation. So, no, the excuse that this is really a left-right thing and so the right place is in the middle, which is, I guess, more of the same, it doesn't seem to line up.
Another issue, Janine Jackson, that sort of is striking to me is that one institution that seems to be unchallengeable and supremely popular, and no politician dares to touch, is Medicare.
Right.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Medicare basically a single-payer system?
That's the thing. And, in fact, some advocates are suggesting that because people don't really know what single-payer is or what single-payer means necessarily, that we refer to it as a Medicare-for-all option, because that's exactly what it is. It's not people don't seem to call that government meddling, you know, or Social Security. When you get your Social Security check, that's not the government getting in your business. No, of course, people are actually familiar with this approach to health care because we do it in some sectors, as with Medicare. And there's absolutely no reason, based on other countries' experience, that we couldn't do that for everyone and that would not be much less expensive. And, in fact, meet the real goal of universal coverage, which is covering everyone. That's another thing that's kind of been lost, as often happens, language. You know, the media somewhere along the line have morphed the word universal health care into meaning a mandate that people purchase health care. Well, that's, you know, demanding that people buy something is not the same as providing it, and yet somehow even that distinction on a linguistic level, I think, has been lost along the way.
Our guest today on Media Matters, Janine Jackson, Program Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, or FAIR. You can hear her program, Counterspin, which she co-hosts and produces every Saturday night right here on WILL AM 580 at 10 p.m. You can go to the terrific website for FAIR at fair.org and see their blog of daily coverage, multiple entries on the events of the day. And healthcare is the dominant issue of the recent blogs, if were you to go there, and you can learn more about this organization. You've been at FAIR for a long time, haven't you, Janine?
Many years. I guess I've been there coming up on 17 years now.
You know, I think it's one of the real testaments to FAIR, to Fairness and Accuracy Reporting, that you and many of the other staff members have been able to make careers there, stay together, and work together. And having been involved with the nonprofit sector for a long time, I know that is highly unusual. What accounts for FAIR's success?
Well, that's an interesting question. Even as a nonprofit, as a small nonprofit, we really have stood the test of time. FAIR's been around since 1986. And, yeah, some of the early, we've got senior staffers who've been there longer than I have. I think it is something about just the individuals. We've got a lot stuck in our craw, and we want to talk about it, you know. But also, it's the work. You know, the media criticism world and the media reform world has just blossomed around FAIR. You know, we were really kind of a lonely outpost back in 1986. Folks weren't used to thinking about media critically, really. I mean, if you worked for a social justice organization, you saw media as a potential ally, and your only question was, how can I get coverage for my events? And that's changed a lot to where people recognize the way that corporate media can actually interfere with our social justice goals and our democratic ideas and ideals. And that has really changed. And so attention to FAIR's work and the sort of reception that FAIR gets in the world has really grown tremendously. And it's very, I guess it's just very encouraging to work there. It's a very positive place to work. People sometimes think criticism involves negativity, but at FAIR, we think we criticize what exists as a way of working towards what is better. And so we're a fairly happy, funny bunch who enjoy showing up to work in the morning.
And how many of the happy, funny bunch people are there at FAIR nowadays?
Well, you might be surprised to know that some people think we have a staff of 40, but we are, in fact, just eight people, really. Nine, I guess. Eight and a half. We've got one part-time person. So, yeah, it's a small group. And as you say, there's some of us, Jim Narikas, the editor of Extra, Steve Rendell, our senior analyst. They've been there a very long time.
And since FAIR started in 1986, really as a pioneer, many other groups and institutions have come along to do similar type work. Probably the most well-known now is a group called Media Matters for America that David Brock started that does similar work. How would you characterize FAIR's work related to what Media Matters for America does?
Well, I think there is certainly a certain amount of overlap. They are much better funded and larger, but while I admire much of what they do, there seems to be a certain amount of fealty to the Democratic Party there. And I think FAIR just politically is more radical than that, you know, and is really we criticize Bill Clinton and George Bush and, you know, and Barack Obama. You know, we're critical of power, whoever is in that seat of power. And we look at those relationships without much concern for partisan interests in that way. And then also, I would say that we absolutely are a left group, but our concern, as you know, Bob, over the years, we talk about top-down bias as much as left-right bias. I think FAIR is still unique in keeping our eye keenly on that corporate ownership, corporate sponsorship, and the way that plays out in terms of the content of the news. That really is our focus, more so than than our Democratic politicians being covered the same as Republican politicians. We will cover that, absolutely, but we're very interested in those ownership questions, which are really go across party lines.
our guest today, Janine Jackson. I said if you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Janine Jackson, the telephone number here at WILL, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. For those of you unfamiliar with FAIR or Janine Jackson, let it be said that anything that's in the news is fair game for questions for our guests today. Let's go to the phone lines right now for our first caller. Line 1, Champaign County, you're on the air with Janine Jackson.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because I do want to say one thing at least about the healthcare debate, and I wanted to give Janine an opportunity to review the rather amazing turnout at their protest of ABC, and I just found out from listening to another Pacifica station that a physician who is had been Barack Obama's physician for many decades, or several decades at least, was again invited to be on ABC, and they turned him down again, apparently. I just heard that this morning. He was canceled, expecting to go on whatever their morning show is called, not one of the talk shows, but chat shows. But so I wanted you to say something about that. There are other places to hear Counterspin, including WFT, as well as on the web. I recommend people check out the interview you did with Sonali Khatyar, and I would like for you to comment on that, because the situation in Afghanistan and the signing on to this terrible battle by the feminist majority, I think, really needs a lot of a whole lot of unpacking, and I think you did a really wonderful job with another Pacifica, that was Pacifica LA host. I thanks for your forbearance, and I'll hang up, I guess.
Thank you very much. Well, FAIR just delivered a petition. We now have 13,000 signatures on a petition which was delivered to ABC News, as the caller was saying, to tell them to stop silencing the option, to stop railroading the conversation on health care reform and keeping the single payer option off the table. ABC had not had a single guest on all year representing a single payer perspective.
Jeannie, what does Obama's personal physician have
to
start?
That's Dr. David Shiner. He's not Obama's physician now. He was for a long time, and he himself has said that he is a proponent of a single payer system and wants to talk about that. He had been invited to an ABC health care forum where it was known that he was planning to ask a question about single payer, and then he was disinvited, as the caller says precisely correctly, disinvited at the last moment. And we had a little conversation. My colleague Isabel McDonald had a conversation with ABC's senior vice president of communications, a guy named Jeffrey Schneider, and he basically scoffed at the notion that Dr. Shiner had been disinvited based on the content of the question he was going to ask. He said, quote, "To draw some kind of nefarious conclusion is simply ridiculous," close quote. Of course, though, when you set it against the backdrop, as we've been discussing, of the larger exclusion of that Medicare for All option from the debate that corporate media have been having, you don't need to think of it as a conspiracy. It's simply a business as usual. The caller also talked about, and I agree that it was a very fascinating interview with Sonali Kolhatkar, who is the co-director of the Afghan Women's Mission. And she was simply talking about something that, you know, Afghanistan has kind of dropped, it's kind of backburnered in the news anymore. But when we do hear about it, you do sometimes get a reference to the notion that it is somehow a liberating mission for Afghan women and girls. This was a big part of the rhetoric, of course, when that war began back in 2001. It's died down a little bit, but still there is this notion that the U.S.-led invasion is a democratizing force there. And what Sonali Kolhatkar was responding to was the fact that the Feminist Majority Foundation and some other prominent liberals like Howard Dean have come forward endorsing the U.S. Mission, if you will, in Afghanistan, and saying that this is, in fact, getting rid of the Taliban is, in fact, going to be, first of all, possible and is going to bring Afghan women their rights, which they've lost. And Sonali was saying, and folks should check out her work certainly independently, just that, you know, actually the situation has not improved dramatically for Afghan women since the war began, as we've been told, and they now have simply the same deprivations and poverty and loss of rights, and now they're in the midst of a war, and that it simply is absurd to imagine that more war is going to make their lives better. She has a lot of work on that subject, of course, and you can find that at Afghan Women's Mission.
Would you say, in your mind, Janine, that the coverage of the Afghan war has changed as we've gone from the Bush administration to the Obama administration? And I think the policy is largely the same. If anything, Obama's expanding the war, but they both are pro-war.
Absolutely. And I don't feel that it's changed in the sense of becoming more challenging, certainly. I mean, it seems to me that when I see Afghanistan in the news, it's generally the most recent story. Well, we're changing our tactics so that we don't kill so many civilians. You know, there's been an acknowledgement that the war has killed a lot of Afghan civilians, and the Pentagon keeps saying, oh, but, you know, we always try to avoid it. First, they deny they've done it, and then 2 days later when the facts come out and they are forced to acknowledge that, oh, in fact, the folks they killed were a wedding party or whatever, you know, then they say, well, we're going to modify our policy such that that doesn't happen anymore. So there seems to be the same kind of endlessly giving credence. It's like the Pentagon has a blank check with the corporate press, and they will always believe them, their new line, until such point as it becomes shown to be obviously false. I don't see any rise to ask harder questions of Obama than were asked of Bush. If anything, I see, you know, the issue has been kind of quieted down. It's not even really a matter of debate. It's really just a news story of a war over there somewhere.
And just turning to the next other war we're engaged in, I noticed this week in the New York Times that a general, and I can't recall his exact title or position, but a U.S. military general wrote a memo to the president basically saying it's time to withdraw completely and just declare victory in Iraq. That really there's really not going to any sort of it's a classic quagmire. And
yes, declare victory.
And declare victory and leave, like they used to joke that should have been done in Vietnam.
Yes.
And it was interesting. It got coverage in the New York Times. I haven't seen much other coverage, but do you think there's going to be an opening now for actually a discussion of how the U.S. might actually literally leave Iraq at some point?
Well, literally leave, no. What I think we're going to see, if history is a guide, is a narrative that says we're leaving and that says, oh, don't look at that permanent base over there. You know, that's not really us being there. You know,
behind that curtain.
Yeah, behind that curtain, exactly. So, no, I don't think there are plans. I mean, talking about Iraq, it just kind of makes my head spin because you have to keep pulling back to illegal invasion of sovereign country. You know, I really can't have a sort of coherent line on, well, are we leaving? Is it now theirs? You know, when you have to realize that, you know, of course, you know, as I know you do and listeners too, we invaded this country, installed a government, basically have our hand on everything economic and all of their resources over there, and also meanwhile are still killing them, you know, fomented civil war, you know, trashed that country. And to now say, oh, now they're on their own and we've left it better. I mean, I don't doubt for a minute that that's going to be the line. And I also expect, as I've seen already, stories that accept fully the idea of, well, now we've turned over power more and there's nothing for the U.S. Marines to do. They're just sitting around playing ping pong because everything is being taken over by Iraqis, and Iraqis are now independently running their country. And it's just, it's so far down the rabbit hole that it's hard to know how to talk about it.
Our guest today, Janine Jackson, Program Director at Fairness in Action Reporting. Phone lines are open at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines. I think we're at line 2 now. Champagne.
Yes, good afternoon. You brought up the question I was going to ask about of what was going to be on FAIR's program last night about the Afghan women, but there are so many questions I would like you to answer or to help us to find where we can get some answers. In Britain, they are starting an investigation, I understand, or an open questioning about how and why they got suckered into Iraq. Do you think our corporate media will ever even talk about that? And how will we in the United States get our information of what's going on with that particular inquiry? And thank you so much for the work that you do, Janine, and all the people at FAIR.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. Well, it's interesting. I mean, I used to think of Great Britain as sort of leading in terms of the critical journalism and, really strong, clear advocacy journalists, and also self-inquiry, into the way the society was working. The bloom is kind of off that rose since the Iraq War. The British press has not been necessarily a million miles better than the U.S. on many things, which has been disappointing. But it is the case that there are public moves, as the caller has referred to really look substantively into the causes for Britain's involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think that is quite different. I mean, here we have, of course, groups that want that, that are calling for that. I would send folks to After Downing Street, David Swanson's organization, which is very focused on that also. But our media have been overwhelmingly of the, and Barack Obama has been as well, let's go forward, let's not look back. It's so disheartening to have a public conversation where we can't talk about, everyone sort of accepts, and you'll see journalists say, oh yes, we were all misled. I mean, they'll acknowledge that the premises for the invasion of Iraq were false, and yet we've skipped over the moment where we really talk about that, where we really lay blame, where we really talk about what happened. Not only have we skipped that conversation, that kind of truth commission, that can be so healing for a country and so informative, we haven't included, and this I'm sure folks have noticed, we haven't even begun including in our conversations the people who were not misled, who were not wrong, the people who accurately predicted how things would go, both in Afghanistan and Iraq. The people who were right are still out of the conversation. The people who were wrong are still leading the conversation. They, of course, don't want to look back. They don't want to figure out, to talk openly about what they did wrong, about what they ignored. So they're not going to have that conversation, and it's going to require people working around the media, around the elite media, to have that conversation ourselves.
To my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, Janine Jackson, the only major news medium that has really examined the media's role in selling the war was the special report Bill Moyers did 2 or 3 years ago on PBS. To my knowledge, none of the commercial news media have really devoted investigative work into that issue.
No, I should know definitively, but I'm going to take your word on that. I know the Moyers thing I'm aware of, and I haven't seen, spotty here and there. And, of course, some folks, folks at Knight Ritter, and McClatchy were folks who were doing good reporting at the time,
Yeah.
And that should be noted. Mm-hmm. And, but no, there is zero interest in corporate media, in examining corporate media's failings. That's, in a way, no surprise, but at the same time, the fact of that really makes it difficult to talk about a lot of things. We can't even talk about the 2000 election because there's this overwhelming water under the bridge, move forward, let's not be divisive. And, of course, pretending that conflicts don't exist does not make them disappear.
Nor does it make good journalism.
No.
Our guest today, Janine Jackson from Fairness in Action Reporting. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters right here in WILL AM 580. The phone lines are open at 333-9455. The toll-free line is open at 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines right now and go to line 4. Fryna, you're on the air with Janine Jackson.
Hello. Thanks. Thank you so much for this program, Professor McChesney. I have two to. I have a million questions, but I actually have a question that's been bugging me forever. Professor McChesney, did you ever host a FM radio rock FM rock station in San Francisco, in the San Francisco Bay Area? You have that voice.
No, I confess I never did.
Okay, okay. Thanks for the answer. All right, one of my things right now is, okay, Democracy Now is just, I have to watch it every day. One of the recent topics they've talked about are these so-called CMUs. And for you, Mr. McChesney, and for Janine Jackson, this is called a communication management unit. You cannot get or receive communications from the outside world. How's that for a hell for you guys? This is a real thing, and they put the quote unquote detainees of America, and I guess who knows, convicted Muslim terrorists in these units. The recent Democracy Now! Program talked about the John Walker Lynn case, where he was put in the Terre Haute unit. There's a unit here in Illinois in Marion, apparently, that's a part of a prison that used to be a supermax. Here's my question and so forth. There were serious crimes of constitutional breach of the Constitution with the Bush administration, which have been continued now with Obama. You can't hold people without trial under U.S. law. You can't hold people forever without charges under U.S. law. They are holding people without charge and without trial. Okay, one other little side issue here is Vincent Bugliosi has dropped off the map after being on Free Speech TV with his prosecution of George Bush for murder book. If you could kind of talk about those issues, the actual constitutional crimes of Bush, talk about it a little bit. And I hate to say this, but Obama has actually done it. He's talked about holding people forever without charge.
That's
impeachable. Okay, I don't want to go on. And thanks so much for this program.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Janine, a bit to chew on there, but I think the important point certainly he's getting at is that there is commonality between the Bush and Obama approach to some extent with regard to some of the war and peace issues.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And in disturbing ways, the Obama Justice Department seems as though they may take things further. The caller is absolutely correct that they floated this idea of sort of preventative detention, that people who haven't committed, we don't know that they've committed a crime. I mean, it's horrific. It is a nightmare world. And along with that, you had a Justice Department official say that you didn't want to, that Dick Cheney's testimony couldn't be brought to, couldn't be made public because he didn't want to see himself, we didn't want future people not to testify because they might see themselves made fun of on The Daily Show. So in other words, we have to keep these things secret and from the public because there might be criticism and people might not want to come to testify. And we say, well, why not just subpoena them? Isn't that what you do to people that you want to testify? The Obama Justice Department official said that would be unseemly. That would be unseemly. So, there's absolutely zero reason to let down our guard on the civil liberties front. And as far as the prisons, it's all part, really, of this horrible nightmare of this war on terror that we have. Remember when media used to put it in quotation marks? Because after all, what the hell is it? If it's a war on terror, when does it end? When are we allowed to say it's over? When do we win? Those quotes have disappeared, and with them has that fundamental question of why are we allowing so many things to be done in the service of this concept of unending war? When did we sign up for that? When did we vote for that? In fact, didn't we vote against that? I think
it's been a real, and people, the caller's outrage, I certainly share. My concern is that many other folks do not, and it's simply because we're kind of swimming in it, if you will. It's so taken for granted. You might read, well, there's a concern about some of the people who are put in these secret prisons. Some of them might not belong there. Well, okay, so you've already bought into the idea that some people do belong there and that it's okay that nobody, journalists and the public, don't know anything about what's going on there. The conversation, the media conversation, accepts so many of these unacceptable premises that it's very difficult to have the fundamental question about civil liberties, about justice, about human rights within that context. And so I know I'm repeating myself, but there are so many reasons that we have to have conversations outside and around the elite media.
Jeanine Jackson, the caller, mentioned Democracy Now!, the program run by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. And earlier I mentioned Bill Moyers. And I think, I suspect you, like me, agree that these are highly regarded journalists who do great work. And they both coincidentally work for non-commercial, non-profit entities. For a long time, I think one of the assumptions many critics of news media made, and I'd put myself in this group, was that the corporate system, the commercial system, would be reluctant to ever air anything that was truly critical. Even if it made money for them, it would go against their sort of broader political and commercial interest. And in recent years, we've seen the emergence on MSNBC of the Keith Olbermann Show and Rachel Maddow's program. And I'm wondering, I don't know how often you watch these shows, I'm wondering if you see these, how this fits into that sort of line of thinking. Does this prove that the corporate system is more flexible? What do we learn from the success of these programs?
Well, let me say a couple of things, because I'm, as you may know, there's breaking news on that very story about Olbermann in particular, and whether, in fact, you are allowed to be critical, or how critical you are allowed to be. What I will say broadly, it's always been the case that there were openings. It's always been the case that you could turn on the TV sometimes and see something that was critical, you know, or that asked a fundamentally challenging question. It's really been more a matter of what is the pattern, what is the usual, what is the standard? Why is there only one Bill Moyers and one Amy Goodman that we get? Why is it really not overall a broad and inclusive debate and conversation? So I think the corporate ownership does still, we do still, not just the corporate ownership, but our U.S. media system does still constrain the conversation and does still largely exclude any sustained substantive criticism of the powers that be, or the socioeconomic status quo. But about folks like Olbermann and Maddow, well, listeners who don't know might be interested to know. Of course, one of the things that Olbermann is sort of famous for was attacking Bill O'Reilly, Fox's Bill O'Reilly. And we all know that Fox's Bill O'Reilly likes to attack Olbermann, and that gets big ratings for both of those shows, is these personal attacks. And not O'Reilly doesn't just attack Olbermann, he attacks General Electric and has sent his producers to ambush
the parent firm of MSNBC.
Exactly, the parent firm of MSNBC. Well, what just happened, that's come to light, is that there was a meeting between the General Electric and therefore MSNBC leader, Jeffrey Immelt, and Rupert Murdoch, who owns News Corp, which owns Fox. And they actually made a deal to stop Olbermann and Bill O'Reilly from criticizing one another on air as of June 1st. And the reason was not, you know, we often say, we think, oh, television's so crappy, but it's just because they just want to get ratings. It wasn't because they were losing ratings. It was because the head of GE and the head of News Corp felt that their non-news corporate entities were being damaged by this public feud. So, and folks might look up, Glenn Greenwald has a column on Salon about this, but I find this a completely outrageous story. This is corporate parents telling their news, ostensibly news division, I mean Fox, okay, we can argue that, but their news division folks, you may not say this on air. It's outright censorship. And the reason is because our other business dealings, because essentially
stockholders were coming into GE stock meetings and saying, What's this O'Reilly talking about our dealings in Iran? You've got to, you know, we've got to make that stop. They were getting heat at a corporate level, and so they censored these hosts. And although Oberman has apparently made one critical comment of O'Reilly since this June 1st détente was established, but has also publicly declared that he's no longer going to talk about him and made it sound as though he was quarantining him, you know, and not that he had gotten orders from above. So are you allowed to be critical of your corporate owners or other corporate owners on that corporate outlet? Not so much.
Yeah, that I saw the story yesterday. I'm glad you mentioned it. Has anyone done any hard digging yet to see, to make sure that O'Reilly hasn't been mentioned in the last 2 months? Do we know that for sure?
Well, that's what Glenn Greenwald took a look at it at Oberman. And as I say, he did find one quite critical mm-hmm. thing since this ostensible beginning, but then nothing since. And has Oberman, and I'm not, you know, I can't vouch for that completely, but and I haven't done the research myself, but he then has Oberman saying, you know, I'm not even going to mention O'Reilly anymore, you know, as of now, because I don't want to build him up by talking about him, essentially. But even if, I mean, the thing about censorship is, even if it doesn't work 100%, the fact that it happened is telling and is chilling and says everything about the climate within these institutions. After all, most folks at MSNBC don't have the status that Keith Olbermann does, you know. Mm-hmm. They also heard that message, you know, that we are not to be critical of Fox, we are not to be critical of O'Reilly. Whatever level they were on, that is the word is out that that's not a career builder at that station. And that's what we mean about a climate of censorship, which isn't always this overt.
Jeanine Jackson, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Phone lines open at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. We have time for one or two more callers if people want to get involved. Jeanine Jackson, the latest issue of Extra is the big issue of our times, in my view. Certainly it's what I've been writing about, which is the crisis of journalism, the loss of jobs, the closing of newsrooms and newspapers. And, you know, as one, you've been in the position of being quite critical of mainstream journalism over the years. Is this necessarily a bad thing that all these guys are going under?
Well, my husband and coworker says, you know, if corporations are deciding that maybe they don't want to be in the news business anymore, you kind of feel like the Foxes are saying they're going out of the hen house protection business, you know. Thanks very much, and best of luck with your future endeavors, you know. Mm-hmm. But for one thing, it's not necessarily really the case, totally. But I would say there's definitely an upside, and maybe it's I'm an optimist, or maybe it's what day of the week you ask me. But as you say, we've always been critical of the U.S. media system in its reliance on corporate owners and on corporate sponsors. We think that has always kind of distorted the democratic conversation, and we have always wanted there to be a greater flourishing of other kinds of models. Not that there's no place in society for a commercial model. I think that there is. I simply don't want it to be, and we don't think it works well for democracy when that is the dominant model and the only way that people really have of having a conversation with one another, learning about what's going on in the world, and so on. So to see that cracking up, I can see definitely positive possibilities in that. I would say what's most positive to me is really what's going on inside people's heads, and that is people coming to realize that, you know, golly, my hometown paper doesn't even come from my state. I can't read news about my local community anywhere. My local television news is just fires and muggings. I need to seek out something better. I need to seek out something different. That's been a change that's been happening in people, as you know, for 10, 20 years now, I think, where people are really saying, I am no longer going to even believe that I can watch half an hour of network TV news and really get a fair understanding of what's going on in the world. People are taking their
their information needs into their own hands in a way that I think is very encouraging and very good for democracy. And with that are coming these smaller independent outlets, many of them online, of course, not as big, never going to have the reach that the New York Times does. But when you combine their existence with the fact that more people are actively seeking independent news sources, I do see something positive there, yes.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines for one more caller. For Janine Jackson, let's go now to line one. Champaign, you're on the air.
Nice to be able to listen to Janine Jackson. You've touched a little bit on this, but I would like you maybe to expand a little bit more. It seems to me that left and right tend to look surprisingly similar when you get up into big business and corporate ownership. And I would also like to know if there are a couple of sources, maybe TV news sources, maybe information sources that are basically untainted, and I know this is a hard one, by either conservative or a liberal bias, that people who don't spend more than maybe 40 minutes a day at the most seeking information might find useful, because truthfully, most of us don't have our world revolve around information sources and bloggers. So if you could just mention a couple of sources, maybe print as well as computer, and talk a little bit more about how left and right tend to look a lot alike when you get to big fortunes. I'll hang up and I'll listen, and thanks a lot.
Thank you, caller. Janine Jackson?
Well, I think about the idea of left and right, I mean, I don't see it exactly that way in terms of what the priorities are of corporate media owners. And the biggest way I can illustrate that is whenever we look at guests on news shows, it's not that, they're all right in the middle or anything. We regularly find what would be considered more progressive and more public interest constituencies underrepresented. That's environmentalists, labor rights groups, civil rights groups, peace activists. You know, these are not all left groups, of course, but if I'm forced to say who gets left out, I'm going to go ahead and say the left gets left out of the media conversation for reasons that are very particular to this country and the legacy of McCarthyism and, you know, the topic for a much longer show. It is, however, true that, that media love bipartisanship, that media love editorially anything that appears to be right in the middle, that appears to be, if we upset conservatives and we upset liberals, we must be doing something right, is I think a kind of mantra in journalism today, and it's a false kind of notion of what it really means to be independent. You know, if, for example, the majority of the country want you to end a war, you're not required to balance that perspective or to silence that perspective just because there are some people on the other side politically who want you to say something different. So there's that. Now, on sources, and Bob, I'll ask for your help with that too, because the truth is I do look at a number of sort of news aggregate sources. I might look at Common Dreams, or I might look at one of the independent media sites, or ProPublica is a good one, that have a number of stories. You know, it's not all just one issue, and they may in fact be links to other outlets that might take me to other, newspapers and things that I've never heard of before, but I'm just following a story. So I would suggest for the caller checking out some of those news aggregate sites where, and you can just do a search on that, and there you'll find a bunch of things condensed and put together for you, because frankly I recognize that not everyone sits around all day reading stories on the internet. And then again, on print, I never want to, I read the New York Times every day, I don't throw it out, there's news in there. The point is really just to change it up, to not hope that you will find one outlet which comes from somehow no perspective, but to read a couple of different ones whose reporting you generally have some some feeling about, and compare them and contrast them, and you know, read a Newsweekly and read Time and read The Nation and read, you know, I mean, some of them I wouldn't read at all, but basically it's an individual choice, because it's going to depend on what length of stories, what kind of depth and complexity you like in your coverage, if you would rather listen to it, for example, or see it rather than read it. We're in a moment where we really can put together our own kind of newspaper every day, but it does take a little bit of work, at least initially, to find that handful of sites that give you, or outlets that give you, the range of interests, the range of coverage that you're interested in.
Janine Jackson, we've only got a few minutes left, and I do want to ask you about the issue of the week, this past week, which is week and a half, 2 weeks now, which was the arrest of Skip Gates in Cambridge and the beer summit at the White House. President Obama called this a teachable moment. Do you think there was a lesson that was taught there?
No, unfortunately not. Well, there's always a lesson that's taught. The question is, what lesson was taught? I mean, I think, unfortunately, what we saw was a real reduction, once again, of inequality and racism to a question of personalities. To, you know, if the story is there's a terrible white racist guy and a blameless black man, and so that's the story. And then you find out, as our guest Diedrich Mohammed said on Counterspin, then if the story becomes, well, no, this white cop actually has some black friends, it's as though we're no longer talking about profiling as a real issue with data attached to it and history attached to it that you can explore as a journalist. It's really just, oh, well, he's not a 100% stereotypical racist, and therefore, you know, the story's kind of over. There's nothing to see here, and can't we all just get along? And I think that's such a common problem when you try to talk about racism, that it becomes something that two men can sit down and have a beer over and work it all out. You know, I'm all for conversation, but we're not talking about individuals. When we're talking about police profiling, when we're talking about structural inequality, we're not just talking about Bob and Sue and Joe. You know, we're talking about systemic, you know, cultural level problems that inordinately discriminate against people of color. And, you know, there's data on this. And I think it was a teachable moment. It was an opportunity. Journalists who, like many people, just get very uncomfortable talking about race and racism preferred to kind of scurry past it instead of actually using it to light something up.
Yeah, Gina Jackson, I mean, I think Bob Herbert had a column in the Times yesterday or Friday, I can't remember which day, on this issue. And what was striking to me was just the two worlds, that a significant more percentage of white Americans, and particularly the news media, seem to be completely unaware of what the black experience with police has been in this country.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a foreign world entirely. And in that case, there's no way they can understand what could have happened.
Absolutely not. And that is something, when journalism done well, that's a void it could fill. You know, you can do journalism that really shows what the experience of police is like for communities of color. You could do that journalism. We just don't see it.
Janine Jackson, our guest today. We've only got about a minute left, Janine. I do want to ask you, if I can, just finally, to go to conservative media, which you spent a long time looking at, Fox and Limbaugh and that crowd, and Ferris, done a long time studying them. And this is a genuine question, it's not rhetorical. I really don't understand what conservatism stands for anymore. I used to know. 10 years ago, I knew. Even 5 years ago, and certainly 20 years ago, there were a certain set of values that I understood defined conservatism. I'm hard-pressed to locate them today. Help me.
Well, good luck with that, because I actually think I would love to hear a conversation among conservatives themselves, because I think you'd find some echo to your concerns. I think many conservatives themselves think that the movement has been, in as much as it was a set of ideas at one point, has been distorted beyond recognition, to where you have, you know, Glenn Beck talking about Obama as Hitler, with Nazis marching in the background. And I just know that conservatives who are really about not intervening in foreign countries and you know, hunting, you know, that they don't think that's not their thing. That's not what they think of as the teabag parties. I'm quite sure do not represent everyone who would call themselves a conservative.
Janine Jackson, I hear the band tuning in the background. Unfortunately, that means it's the end of our show. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And I want to take this moment to send out a special thanks to Andrew Boyle, who served as my producer for the past many years. Last week was his last week. Andrew's moving on to a new position to teach this fall in upstate New York. He did a wonderful job. He'll be replaced ably by Melissa Trent starting next week. This week we had Jay Pierce sitting in doing a great job. And I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters here in WILAM 580. I'll see you in 167 hours.
Made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance. Private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, we'll see sunny skies today with a high of 79 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear with a low of 59. Monday brings mostly sunny skies with a high of 88 degrees, and Monday night mostly cloudy skies with a 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, a low reaching 68. This is Illinois Public Media, WIL.